This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Lee Smith's novels are known for bringing readers straight to the heart of the American South. She creates vivid characters against a southern landscape to show the importance of place in her stories. In fact, Lee Smith learned the art of storytelling in coal country of Virginia, where she grew up. She started writing at the age of 9 and sold her stories for a nickel apiece, many of them inspired by the gossip, true stories, and other lies she heard at her father's dime store. Lee Smith's career blossomed when she moved to North Carolina. She's written 17 works of fiction and has become a beloved best-selling author. But her newest book is a memoir. It's called Dime Store, A Writer's Life, and it celebrates that small town in Virginia that planted the seed for her life as a writer. Lee Smith is back on the State of Things. Welcome back, Lee. So good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank. I'm always glad to be here.
It's a pleasure. But now this is memoir. You have to put yourself out there.
Oh, no.
Was it hard?
Yeah. It was really scary. And I was very surprised when I found that this was what I was writing. And it was actually, I can tell you exactly when I decided. My hometown of Grundy, Virginia, has just gone through this huge flood control project. Grundy has two problems going for it right now. One was continued flooding, and so they did this flood control project. And another, of course, is the death of coal, which is causing a great deal of unemployment and so on now. But anyway, the downtown had become a ghost town because Grundy had flooded 9 times in the last, 25 years. Mm. And so it had become a ghost town and all the stores had closed. I went there for my daddy's to close his dime store in 1992, which he had operated for 55 years. It was very tragic. And actually, he died on the last day of after closing his dime store. Mm. I mean, he died on the last day of selling the fixtures and everything. So all of this is a big thing, I guess, in my mind. So I went back up there when they finally got the funds to, raise the town up to higher ground and build a ring wall that would keep it from flooding. It involved a big highway construction project and all kind of stuff. But they had to demolish the entire Main Street as it existed. So I went up there to see him blow up 55 stores, including Daddy's Dime Store and so on. I was writing this up actually for the Washington Post. And it was very emotional. It was so emotional that I really couldn't go when they demolished my parents' home, the only home they'd ever lived in. But right before that, the neighbors got together and they went and they removed the S that was on the front door for Smith, this big brass S of the door knocker. And one of them had a hobby of woodworking and he made a shadow box, a box frame and sent it to me. So this arrives in Hillsborough, North Carolina, where I live. And I didn't know that it was coming. And I opened the box and I looked at it and just burst into tears and immediately started writing furiously my own sort of verbal, written snapshots of all the places that had just been destroyed and all the people that had lived there and the lives they'd lived and who they were and what they loved and believed in and so on. And I just began writing nonfiction to sort of set it down.
Did you ever
to have a record? And I never have done that before, so I just kept going.
You kept going. But this is the, you said 1992?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Now,
the demolishing of the house. This project was huge, involving the moving of roads and whole mountains to get another flat place. I have a higher up flat place and all this kind of stuff. So this was only, I guess, 4 years ago when the house was demolished.
So take us back to Grundy, Virginia, in the 40s and 50s when you were growing up.
Well, it was just, this book is really a love song to that time and to that place, but really to all our little hometowns of the heart across America, I think, when towns had a main street. Mm-hmm. And the main street consisted of family-owned businesses and so on. And you knew everybody, and everybody knew you and who your people were and so on. And so I was very privileged to grow up there in that time and to spend a whole lot of time in the dime store.
In the dime store with a privileged view of the customers.
Oh, yeah. Well, here were my jobs in the dime store. My main job was taking care of the dolls. And I made up huge stories about each one of the dolls, you know, things that had happened to them before they got to the dime store and things that would happen to them after they left my care. And I took really good care of them. And each one of them, I made up a name for them. Each one of them had three names, like Mary Elizabeth Satterfield for a very ladylike doll, or Baby Betsy Black, you know, for a sassy little baby doll, or whatever.
And how old are you at this point when you're actually making up backstories?
Eight, nine, ten.
You're not even terribly bothered when they go because you can keep their story alive.
I'm going to get some more, right.
Well,
and
they're getting
I can
more,
keep
but,
the story yeah. alive. Yeah. And my favorite thing was, of course, getting them ready for Christmas, where I would put their arms up like this so they could hug any little girl that got them. And so anyway, I was very involved. And also, I got to go upstairs in Daddy's office, which sort of hung over the whole floor of the store. And it had a one-way glass window. So we could be up in the office. I was up there with my own little typewriter. And I was looking out, and I could see every single thing happening in every aisle of the store, whether it was fabrics or the candy counter or the tool or, you know, anything. And I could see everybody, but nobody could see me. So I witnessed everything. I witnessed huge romantic kisses and fights and slaps and shoplifting and all this. I mean, it was the perfect.
You are the omniscient writer.
I was the omniscient writer. I mean, it was the perfect sort of study. And one time I saw this woman shoplifting, and she put this huge Philco radio between her legs under her big coat, mm-hmm. and just waddled all the way out of the store. And I never told because I just wanted to see if she would make it. And then I knew my daddy would be so mad that I hadn't told, but I could never tell.
Your daddy encouraged you writing in some ways. I mean, he built you a writer's cottage.
He did.
Of sorts.
He did. Well, I think this has to do with the fact that I was born so late in life to my parents, who had been told that they could never have a child. And so really, frankly, I think whatever I was spoiled to death, and whatever I seemed to be interested in, like if I had said I wanted to be an axe murderer, they would have bought me an axe. You know, that's what I'm saying. So, but I was really interested in stories and books and writing from a very early age. So my daddy built me a little writing house down on the riverbank. And every time it flooded, which it did repeatedly, he'd build it back. And sometimes he built it, and sometimes it was a little prefab house, you know, like a little shed or something that you'd get from the Mingo Lyman Lumber Yard or whatever. But anyway, I was certainly encouraged.
And you wrote. I mean, you actually wrote it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So what kinds of things were you writing?
Well, my cousin Martha Sue and I had a newspaper, which we wrote every week, and we copied laboriously by hand and sold to the neighbors for a nickel, for instance. And so, do you want to read?
Yeah.
Okay, all right. I got in so much trouble for my newspaper. It was named The Small Review, and I get in lots of trouble for my editorial, such as George McGuire is too grumpy. And especially my opinion that, quote, this is from an editorial, Mrs. Ruth Boyd is a mean music teacher. She hits your fingers with a pencil, and her house smells like meatloaf all the time. So I immediately got to quit taking music lessons, as you can imagine, which is my first example of the power of the press. And also, here's another news item. I love this. It shows you how far sort of back in the country we were, I guess. Miss Lee Smith and Miss Martha Sue Owens were taken by car to Bristol, Virginia, to buy school shoes. They got to look at their feet in a machine at Buster Brown. And guess what? Their bones are long and green. And I was writing, you know, also just little stories. And I was particularly, I think I always loved to read more than anything, Frank.
What's interesting, you love to read. You had this bird's eye view on all this kinds of all this great behavior, human behavior,
yeah,
at the store. And, of course, you're in the heart of storytelling country.
That was mainly it.
I was interested to see that you were saying that it wasn't so much for you as a writer. Now, the fact that you sort of learned storytelling by listening to stories, you were less interested in that than you were in creating stories.
Well, I think those two go hand in hand. I mean, I think I'm more of a storyteller than a writer.
Yeah.
I'm not a writerly writer so much. And really, I think when I think of practically so many nights of my childhood, because I was the child among older people, you know, I was the child falling asleep in somebody's lap on somebody's porch, trying desperately to stay awake long enough to hear the end of the story. So even today, when I'm writing fiction, stories come to me in a human voice. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's the voice of the main character or another character in the story. And sometimes it just seems to me to be the voice of the story itself. But that's the way it happens. So I think I'm much more of a storyteller, really, than a writer, and that's why I went to fiction.
We'll talk more about that with my guest today, Lee Smith, who's a best-selling author, 17 works of fiction. Her latest, a memoir, it's not one of those 17 works of fiction. In fact, it is a memoir, and it was released last month, and it's called Dime Store, A Writer's Life. More with Lee Smith just ahead, including her move to North Carolina. And you'll hear about it on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio with best-selling author Lee Smith. Her newest book is a memoir called Dime Store, A Writer's Life. And we talked about growing up in coal country in Virginia, Grundy, Virginia, a place that has been gotten a makeover recently. You were there when it was a small town with a main street and a dime store right in the middle of it, your father's dime store. You also write about coping with your parents' mental illness in this book.
Yeah. I think, you know, I just wanted to, the name of this book is sort of A Writer's Life. And I think for me, as for any child whose parents have any sort of illness, that does determine a lot, you know, that does determine a lot of things. In my case, my father suffered from periodic depression, which was absolutely immobilizing. And my mother from just fits of nerves, as she called it, you know, from anxiety and depression both. And they were both hospitalized many times. Usually first one and then the other, only rarely at the same time when I would go off to stay with some aunt or uncle. And so this is my story, but it's not a sob story because with such a wonderful extended family in such a wonderful town where people would step in and make sure you got to go to the Girl Scouts, you know, or whatever. But I want to say one thing about why I'm choosing to write about this, too, because I'm so against the stigma that has attached to mental illnesses of all sorts, and these are treatable illnesses. You know, they may be lifelong illnesses, just like leukemia or something, or arthritis, but they're all treatable. And I just, you know, I feel very strongly about bringing this out into the open and so on, and about bettering our facilities for taking care of these most vulnerable citizens.
Well, in your telling of it, the saddest part of your father's mental illness was his sense of stigma, his sense of shame.
Well, see, that's when and a book made a big difference for him. And I want my book to make a difference for people, too. Yeah, he felt like it was a character flaw.
Yeah.
And he would say, I just can't believe I've gone and got myself in a shape like this. And he was so embarrassed. And then, right when he was getting over, and in an incredibly strong for me image of that kind of paralysis, he suffered from severe depression. I remember visiting him once. I had him down at Duke Hospital, and the doctor told him to draw a picture of a man doing something he enjoyed. And my daddy's little picture was just a stick figure with the man's hands down like this and the man's feet and no features on his face at all. And not long after that, I took Daddy to hear William Steyer. I had taken Daddy before when I had been at Hollins College, because he was a reader. He liked to read, and I had taken him to hear William Styron read, and Daddy had enjoyed a number of his books. Well, then, at this later point, when he was suffering from depression, so William Styron had just published his book, Darkness Visible, in which he is very frank about his own severe depression. Right. And I gave this little book to my father to read, and it just galvanized him. And he said, I can't believe that a man like this, you know, a great writer, a man like this would write about such things, would write about these things. He said, he's exactly right. It's just like it. This is the way it is. And he wrote him a letter and got a letter back.
And you said that things actually got better for your father.
Actually, yeah, toward the end of his life, things got better. I think sometimes, and his was a bipolar depression, which sometimes does ease up. It's sometimes more severe early on and sometimes eases up. But also medications got better. And so on.
But the sense that yes, this is not anything I should be ashamed
of. No, this is an illness.
Famous people have it.
And once he would mention this, well, other people he knew were suffering from it, and so on. And I think it's so important, you know, that book made such a difference to him. And I think it's important for us to, you know, to seek help, to be open about all these things, and to work within our communities for facilities for people, particularly people who need, you know, housing and so on after they get out of the hospital.
Well, and we certainly don't do that now. I mean, we've deinstitutionalized. The idea was home settings or outside institutions would be better. But the idea that medical help would follow was part of that, and that seems not to have happened. And maybe even the theory that there are some people who really need to be in institutions.
Well, yeah, I'm sure that's true. But in this area of North Carolina, we're doing pretty well because we have places like Club Nova and Threshold who are following the clubhouse model, you know, for people who are in their communities but need a community of their own for support and so on. And we have, you know, UNC Mental Hospital Step Clinic that follows patients when they get out. And, you know, all sorts of things happening through this Center for Excellence about, you know, you can work on a farm and you can do this and you can do that and things for people. And my son Josh, who was schizophrenic, was very lucky to be a part of Caremore Community, which offers vocational training and housing and a whole lot of help in somebody can help you and come and help you do your job so you learn to work again after a severe illness.
And bringing the families in on this.
Bring the families in. Yeah.
Well, you tell the story of meeting when your father was hospitalized. You went to visit him. You were 13, I think, at the time.
Yeah.
And a doctor sat down with you concerned about how you were taking all this.
Oh, it was amazing because I had gotten the idea, of course, from my parents that I was not to mention their illnesses to anyone. That say, well, they've just, you know, they're not home right now. They've gone away, whatever, you know, and just not mentioned that this was somehow shameful. And of course, I was amazed when my mother's doctor, that she was hospitalized at the University of Virginia, and her doctor was a Dr. Stevenson. Yeah. And he said, when Lee comes again, he'd read my little letters, you know, to my mother, when Lee comes again, I would like to take her out to lunch, which was an unheard of kind of thing. So I get all dressed up. I go visit my mother. I'm taken out to lunch where I'm given a club sandwich. I'd never seen such a thing. Cut in four triangles with little flags on it.
Is this three slices
of bread? It was great, yeah. But anyway, we talked about books that I'd been reading. I said a poem to him. You know, we talked about things. And then he said, I wonder if there are any questions you have for me. And I said, oh, no, no questions. And he said, well, I wonder if you ever worry, since both your parents are ill, that you might have this illness yourself, that you might get sick yourself. And I just was galvanized because, of course, this is what I worried about all the time. This is what I thought about all the time. And nobody had ever mentioned it to me. And, of course, I was very carefully trying not to mention it. And he said, well, he said, I'm an excellent doctor. He said, I'm a very, very good doctor. And I've had a wonderful conversation with you today. And you're a very smart little 12-year-old girl. And I can assure you that you're perfectly normal in every respect. And I see no indication. He said, so you can just grow up and you can live your life and read some more books and get a good education. And of course, he was just telling me that, but it was the thing I needed most to hear at that moment.
How much of that do you think was just the reassurance from a guy who says, I'm a good doctor, so he must know? And how much was just the fact that he called you, that you got it out? That I think
the fact that I got it out, because that's the whole point, I think, of therapy, is that you talk about these things and you get them out in the open, and then they're not so scary. You can do it. And this is what I've found, I think, Frank, one reason I have found writing itself to be so therapeutic for me is that if you write about things, and then it's like you line them up. It's one word lined up after another on a piece of paper, and there they are out in the open, outside of your crazy brain. And you're not depressed, and you're not
structure,
so worried about
them. They're rattling around like,
that's
sort of
right.
Like
so,
a
so you give them structure, you give them a sentence, and you put them in a paragraph, and suddenly, you're thinking much more constructively.
You went to Hollis in Roanoke, right?
Hollins, H-O-L-L-I-N-S,
And Hollins, were you expecting to be a writer when you went to Hollins?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
had very ridiculous ideas about being a writer. But yeah, I mean,
ridiculous ideas?
Well, I had ever done was read and write, and I love to read and write. Yeah. So I thought, I'm going to be a writer. But my ideas about being a writer, at that time were that I would wear a black turtleneck, and smoke cigarettes constantly and probably live in Paris and be glamorous and all these things that I was not. And I didn't know anything, of course, about writing or the reality of any writer's life.
Until you met Eudora Welty.
My teacher, Louis Rubin, who would much later found Algonquin Books in Chapel Hill, actually. But my teacher, Louis Rubin, was one of the first champions of Southern writers. And he had Miss Eudora Welty come to our campus when I was just a freshman, second semester freshman year. And frankly, I had never heard of her. And he was already championing her work and had brought her there to give her the Hollins Medal or something. But I did notice when she showed up in the class that the whole back of the class was filled with other faculty standing up and graduate students, boys that we never saw, from UVA and so on, where it was just filled. And so she read the most beautiful story. It's named A Worn Path. It's very simple. It's the story of an old African-American lady named Phoenix Jackson who takes a long walking trip through the forest to get some medicine for her grandson. That's all that happens, and she meets various people and so on along the way. Somebody gives her a piece of marble cake, and all kinds of things happen. And I was just struck. I mean, it was the most beautiful story I had ever heard. And then she finished. She had this quick voice for a Southern writer, this tripping kind of quick lilting voice. And at the end she said, any questions? And this bearded guy, looking somewhat like you, Frank, in the back of the classroom, was just waving his hand. And so she said, yes. And he said, Miss Welty. And now I know, from what I know now, that his dissertation was probably writing on this. But he said, Miss Welty, I wonder if you could tell us how you happened upon the perfect symbol of the marble cake as a union of the temporal and the eternal and the male and the female principles, the union of yin and yang. And he's making all these yin-yang shapes with his hands. And she just looked. I had no idea what he was saying. And she just looked at him and she said, well, she said, that recipe has been in my family for years. And I just, light bulbs went off in my head because my mother made the best marble cake in town. And suddenly I realized that maybe I, too, could write about simple things and simple people, small town, the stuff I really knew, and that the things of my own life might somehow be a fit subject.
Had you already,
for writing.
Had you already bought the beret, or did they save you from?
Well, I didn't have a beret, but
you didn't have that yet.
I didn't have the beret, but I had some turtlenecks.
You had the turtleneck. So this is great. So now you realize that you too can be a writer and don't have to have all the affectations.
Yeah.
Your first novel, in fact, was your thesis project, right?
It was. Yeah, my senior thesis.
Which apparently your mother was not impressed with.
Oh, God, my mother was not impressed.
Yeah.
It was about a little girl, much like myself, who loved to read and write and so on and had a lot of imaginary friends and blah, blah, blah. And in the novel, the reason this little girl was so obsessed with her imaginary friends and so on was because her mother had run off with a man, with a lover. But of course, that part was made up. Well, I published this novel. It's going to be Harper and Row is bringing it out. I send a copy to my mother. Don't hear a word. So I call her up and I said, Mama, did you get the novel? And she said, yes, I did. And I said, well, what do you think? And she said, I have thrown it in the river. I said, what? What do you mean you threw it in the river? And she said, well, she said, everybody in this town is going to think that I have run off with a man. I said, Mama, you're still there. You're still there. You've been married to Daddy for 30 years. Come on. And she said, it doesn't matter. That's what they'll think. And so I have taken steps so that no one else in this town will ever read that book. And I said, what do you mean? What steps? And she said, well, I have told Lillian Elgin, that's her best friend, the town librarian, that she can never, ever order that book, and she has promised. And I have told your father, my daddy's dime store being the only place in town you could possibly buy a book, that he can't order the book either, and he never will. And he never did. None of them ever read that book, which is probably just as well. But it's true. My first case of censorship.
But it does give you the idea that even when we're writing fictional characters,
yeah,
it obviously comes out of our own. And some of that stuff would have sounded to people of Grundy like they so recognizable.
Well, mother was sort of right, because yeah, unless you know about literature and so on, yeah, about the choices of point of view,
right,
as simply a technique, then people think that anyone,
sure,
writing from the point of view of I, which I was doing,
right,
just as a point of view,
right,
character, that it was really Lee saying this.
Now, let's talk about getting you to North Carolina, because you were teaching in seventh grade in Nashville before you came to North Carolina. Then you get a job at Carolina Friends School, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I did. I just, I didn't have a teaching degree, but I had taught a lot at this private girls' school, mm-hmm, Harpeth Hall in Nashville. And so when we were moving, my first husband had gotten a job, James C., as a poet, and he'd gotten a job at UNC. And so here we come to Chapel Hill, and I know I'm going to need a job. So I sort of did it by mail and on the phone. I got a job at a private high school named Carolina Friends School. And so we move in. I get all dressed up to go for my first day at the Carolina Friends School. And I'm wearing a red linen suit and little patent leather heels. At first, I can't even find the Friends School because I'm driving. It looks like it's back in the woods, and all I see are some, kind of old log buildings, and I think this can't be a school. And then finally, I do run into some old guy. I think he's the caretaker. It turns out later he was the head of the lower school or something. But and so he says, well, I think they're all up there. I said, I'm going to the high school. And he said, well, they're all up there. It was a big log building. He says, I think they're settling in. I said, what? And he said, well, settling in. He said, go on up there. So I go up. I open the door. There's like 100 people on the floor, sort of wearing just blue jeans and cutoffs, and some of them have bare feet, and they all act like they're praying or something. They're meditating, I find out later. Some of them are lying down, some of them are sitting down, and I don't know what to do. So they're in a big circle, and I see a guy across that I think might be Don Wells, who was the guy, the head of the school that had hired me. So I begin walking through the middle of this hardwood floor in my high heels, and I'm walking through all these meditating people of all ages. I've never seen such a thing. So I'm walking across, and all of a sudden there's a wolf whistle, and then there's like 100 wolf whistles, and then I just crack up, and yeah, everybody cracks up, and Don Wells gets up and hugs me, and that was my first day at the Friends School. And then they went out and they started doing these ropes courses and things. And, mm-hmm, of course, I had to take off my shoes and my stockings and climb up the ropes and do all this stuff. And Oh, my Lord. It was much more of an education for me. I think teaching has been always, I've learned more than my students ever learned. And I learned a lot at Carolina Friends School.
Once you got your wardrobe worked out, what was it that you learned? Because these are high school kids, right?
These are high school kids.
So what did you learn?
Well, for one thing, Don said, I mean, I thought they would just hand me a curriculum. Mm-hmm. And they would say, okay, you're teaching high school English. You're supposed to teach these books. Instead, they said, what do you want to teach? Mm-hmm. You know, what kind of things you want to teach? We try to make this interesting.
Right.
You know, what kind of thing? And you could make up your courses. And all this, and at first I was terrified, and then I started making stuff up. For instance, I had a course in radio. You'll love this, in radio drama for kids, particularly boys who didn't like to write, but they love machinery.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we would write plays, and we would do a new show every morning, and we would do all this stuff, and people that hadn't been writing at all were suddenly writing. We were all on the air, and we were doing radio drama, too, with detectives and all kinds of stuff. It was just fabulous. Really, really fun. And then also for myself, you know, when we had these faculty meetings, they would throw out things because they were just making up the school. Mm-hmm. You know, they were just graduating the first seniors. And, you know, and every teacher had to participate, and they'd say, well, what do you think about such and such? What do you think? And you had to think something. And the students had to think, too.
We will find out more about what Lee Smith has been thinking and is thinking now. Her memoir is called Dime Store Writer's Life. Our conversation continues after this. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking to Lee Smith today, best-selling and award-winning author, 17 works of fiction, now out with a memoir called Dime Store. So teaching in North Carolina at the Friends School, learned a lot teaching high school kids, and then at a certain point decided to help create the creative writing course at NC State. Tell us about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think I was lucky enough to, I just sort of snuck into college teaching, frankly. Because I have never gotten a PhD, you know, and so on. So, but I had published several novels, and I was divorced by then. I needed a, quote, real job. Mm-hmm. And so a job came open at North Carolina State University, which has always had a strong tradition of creative writing, with Guy Owen, the great writer, starting it really way back. Mm-hmm. And so, but I was terrified to even apply. And Doris Betts, you know, who had somewhat the same position at UNC, mm-hmm. you know, where she had taught for years and years and didn't have a PhD either. So I went to talk to her and I said, do you think I can do this? And she said, don't give me any crap. Go for it. And so I did. And mm-hmm. I was just terrified. And to my total surprise, I got the job and, you know, had it for about 20 years and just absolutely loved it. And I particularly loved, I think, teaching at North Carolina State because we had a whole lot of older students coming into, you know, returning students coming into our creative writing workshops and so on. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the stories were not just about what happened to you last weekend, but about, you know, they were whole life stories. There was a great deal of information, you know, coming in. And now, of course, that this has all morphed into the, when I was there, you could do a book of stories, a book of poems, or whatever as your thesis. Now we have the whole Master of Fine Arts program, right, which is run by Wilton Barnhart. And, you know, it's really quite wonderful.
It was even the scary thing about that to take on the job. I mean, clearly, you don't have a PhD, but you're an accomplished writer, so you know what you're doing. And I guess maybe the tricky part is figuring out, well, how do I teach this? I mean, had you figured out, again, working
well,
with...
Well, you know, I think you learn by doing. Just as in, you know, so many jobs. And I had been in many wonderful creative writing workshops at Hollins. I had been in writing workshops for 4 years. And I had had, you know, and I had seen how they work. And so I had seen techniques that, you know, that really worked and other teachers who were not so good at it. Yeah. And also, I guess, I think I really like people.
Yeah.
And I've always felt like if I hadn't become a writer, I might really wish to be a psychiatrist or a psychiatric social worker or something. So my idea is to make the group work, you know, as a group and make sure that everyone has a chance to participate and listen to each other. And there are various techniques that you can use to make sure that happens.
Well, including you, and you talked about learning from students, your openness and willingness to learn from students. And maybe there's no better example than your experience with Lou Crabtree.
Okay, let me give you, this is going to be a little tiny reading from one of the pieces in the book. It was the hot, muggy summer of 1980. I was up in Abingdon, Virginia for a week to teach a creative writing class. We had already gone around the table and introduced ourselves when here came this old woman in a man's hat and fuzzy pink bedroom shoes, gray head shaking a little with palsy, huffing and puffing up the stairs, dropping notebooks and pencils all over the place, greeting everybody with a smile and a joke. She was a real commotion, all by herself. "Hello there, young lady," she said to me. "My name is Lou Crabtree, and I just love to write." My heart sank like a stone. Here was every creative writing teacher's nightmare. The nutty old lady who will invariably write sentimental drivel and monopolize the class. "Pleased to meet you," I lied. The week stretched out before me, hot and miserable in eternity. But I had to pull myself together. Looking around at all those sweaty, expectant faces, I began, "Okay, now I know each one of you's brought a story to read to the group, so let's start out by thinking about beginnings, about how we start a story. Let's go around the room, and I want you to read the first line of your story aloud." So we began. Nice lines, nice people. We got to Lou, who cleared her throat and read this line, quote, "Old Reller had 13 miscarriages, and she named every one of them." I sat up. "Would you read that line again?" I asked. "Old Reller had 13 miscarriages, and she named every one of them," Lou read. I took a deep breath. "Keep going," I said. "Only of late, she got mixed up and missed some. This bothered her. She looked toward the iron bed. It had always been exactly the same. First came the prayer, then the act with old man gratifying himself." She read the whole story. It ended with the lines, quote, "You live all your life and work things up to come to nothing. The bull calf bawled somewhere." "Well, I'd never heard anything like it. Lou," I asked her after class, "have you written anything else? I'd like to see it." The next day, she came with a battered suitcase. "This ain't all either," she said.
There we go. Lee Smith reading from the chapter On Lou's Porch, one of the essays in Dime Store, A Writer's Life, her latest memoir. Incredible story. You were obviously blown away.
I was blown away, and, you know, I learned so much from her. And actually, I typed all that stuff up, too, and the book was published.
What else was in the suitcase?
Well, all kinds of poems and other stories that she'd been writing all her life. She'd had an incredibly difficult life, having five children in 7 years and living out on an old farm and all this kind of stuff, boiling diapers out in a big pot. I mean, all this stuff. And she had been writing the whole time. And this was my first time I got a completely clear notion of just writing to make sense of your life.
And she was somebody who, I mean, you go on to describe some of her ideas and some of her mystical visions, but she would see ghosts, and it doesn't sound crazy.
No.
And she has also these kind of brilliant insights on kind of, not being worried at all about death her sense of death.
No, that it's a continuation of life and all this. And I went, you know, that's the first time I went and sat on Lou's porch, but I would sit on it for the entire rest of her life, at least once a year more. I would go up and visit with her, and she was remarkable. So she published a book of her stories with LSU Press, and then a book of her poetry was published too, and the state of Virginia gave her a big writing award and so on. And she said toward the end, she said, "Well," she said, "I'm going to die now before long." And she said, "Will you preach at my funeral?" And I said I would. And I did.
And you did?
Mm-hmm.
What'd you say?
I just read a lot from her work. Yeah.
You talk with, but there is a difference, right? I mean, this is extraordinary, the sense of being, no, is it? Because there's also sort of writing as therapy, and it shouldn't be published. I mean, right,
exactly.
There is a certain amount of stuff that might be good for you.
I write a lot of stuff like that, too. But I mean, and sometimes I think, Frank, that publication is maybe among the last reasons to write.
Hmm.
You know.
Do you think that what separates, do you think, that kind of writing, which can be therapeutic for you, honest, a way of organizing your life and organizing your thoughts, and that which would appeal to all of us?
I don't know. I just think if you're, I think I have an instinct about it, and I think anybody who does both kinds of writing does. I mean, you're just writing something down to remember it for yourself, you know, or you're writing something down that might have some sort of a shape and be an essay or be a short story or whatever.
Well, let's take something like oral history, which I think is one that you talk about being. I mean, obviously, these are you're working from stories that you've gathered and stories that you've asked others to gather. Where is the fiction in that? Oral history, yeah. Which can certainly seem to readers like a highly autobiographical book, and yet you've got, this is a novel, right?
Yeah, it's really a novel.
Right.
Well, that was a book in which I was really trying to tell the story of one mountain family over 100 years and let it pass from one speaker to another, from generation to the next. It was a witch puts a curse on one of the women, and it follows down, and so on. And I was just trying to show how a lot of things had changed in one holler, you know, in my neck of the woods over 100 years. And it was really fiction. It was really all fiction. But when I first started writing it, I was just writing it in plain old standard American English.
Mm-hmm.
And it just was not working out. And finally, I thought, well, I need to, what I'm interested is people telling their stories. I need to make up some characters whose lives will exemplify what I want to say, you know, at each point. And one of them needs to be an outsider, the school teacher who comes to do good, you know, and one of them needs to be such and such, you know, and like that. So they're really, they were not anybody's stories except people that I was making up.
Tell me more about Ivy Rowe. The protagonist in Farrington.
Oh, well, that, you know, it's really funny, Frank. I wrote this book in 1980, a long time ago. And yet of everything that I've ever written, Ivy Rowe was the most important character to me because she became like my good friend, sort of. She's a mountain woman. And again, I trace her life. She was born in 1900. She was born with a century. She says she's born in 1900. And I trace her life, which, again, was a kind of a hard life. I think I got the idea for her from Lou Crabtree because her way of making sense of her life, Ivy Rowe's way, was to write letters to her many sisters and so on. And she wrote letters to everybody. And so this is a book told in letters all the way through. And when I first began writing it, all of a sudden a whole lot of things started going wrong in my own life. My mother went into what would be her final illness. My son Josh was diagnosed with schizophrenia, was in the hospital, was very ill at that point. I was getting a divorce. All these things were happening at once. And so it was a good thing I was writing a book in the form of letters, because I didn't have to, I could just write them at bedsides, you know, and so on. And the worse things got, sort of, the harder, and I had to keep my job at NC State during this time. I just had to have that job. So it was like the harder things got, the stronger Ivy Rowe got. I mean, she was just full of sass and vinegar. You know, whatever happened, she could take it. And so she was the friend I needed. She was the friend I needed. And I realized toward the end of writing that book that Mama was going to die. And I just couldn't stand to write the end of the book because then I thought she would die, you know. And so finally Mama died, and then I was able to write the end of Fair and Tender Ladies. But I've never had a character that seemed so real to me or took me over, in such a way. And I think I wanted her life to be every woman's life.
Do you go back and think, do you think about her now? I mean, do you go back and do you revisit, like your dolls in the dime store? Do you extend her story?
Sort of. But you know what's happened? This is so weird. I have, I know of 14 different little girls that were named Ivy. Hmm. Because their mothers read that book when they were pregnant, and there's a birthing scene in it or something. So I get, like, at Christmas, I get, you know, all these pictures of little Ivies, which is just kind of amazing.
Well, she burns the letters, and this gets back to what you were saying about the act of writing.
Yeah.
And
she does. She burns the letters at the end.
And says the letters didn't mean anything in the end. It was the writing them that signified.
It was the writing of them. That signified, yeah, it was what they meant to her.
Well, to what extent does that also mean it signified, the writing signified, it suggests that you're going to act. I mean, there is some form of action that is still meaningful.
Yes,
right. I'm not going to not do anything.
Right, exactly. But it was the writing of them that signified it was what they had meant to her as a way to make it through the night and to figure out how to act and what to do at each point.
You have been classified as a Southern writer, and that can have a kind of mixed meaning to people. Some people, you know, run away from it and don't want to be called a regional
writer. Well, they do, and some people who were actually born in the South simply refuse to be classified as Southern writers. Right. And but, you know, I don't mind a bit. In fact, I welcome it just because I am a writer to whom place is so significant. I mean, before I write anything, I have to draw big maps, you know, on butcher paper, and, like, put them up all over my office. I mean, maps of people's houses, maps of parlors, maps of towns, maps of imaginary counties, or whatever it might hope to be. So I can't possibly dodge that designation.
Well, it seems to
dodge
me that
designation.
The problem is, and the reason people run from it is they suggest it's something like being only a Southern writer, as though it's some kind of a crutch, or that I'm going to name the town and everybody in that town is going to read my book and that's how I'm going to sell it. But it strikes me that it's pejorative. Yeah, but when it works well, it means it is something so rooted in a place that you are palpably aware of that place and visualize it, and yet the themes are universal.
Here's what I think. I think the best, I made up a definition once of regional writing, period. And it is, you just have to ask yourself a question. Could this story or this novel take place anywhere else on earth? And if the answer is no, it's probably regional writing, which would include, for instance, Faulkner's Yachna Patapa, which would include, you know, Elizabeth Strout's Olive Kitteridge in the state of Maine, which would include, you know, Alice Munro's stories set in the lonely Canadian, you know, countryside. I mean, there are a lot of writers that are regional writers because the place has determined so much the boundaries and the content of their lives, lives of the characters.
What are you working on?
Oh, my goodness. Well, well, I don't know. I got so into writing this nonfiction that now several things have occurred to me that I really should have written to put in this book. So
you
I may write
nonfiction?
A few more nonfiction pieces. But I'm actually working on a series of stories about older people. And the name of it is Silver Alert.
Stay tuned. Come back. Bring them back. We'll take you every time, so we can't wait for the next publication. The latest is Dime Store, the author, of course, Lee Smith, best-selling author, 17 works of fiction. Now her memoir is called Dime Store, A Writer's Life. And you can find out more about the book and Lee Smith at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, Charlie Shelton Orman, Robin Copley is our technical director. Brent Wolf is our news director. Thanks for being on the show, Lee.
Well, Frank, thank you.
North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.